Talk given Saturday, 27th January, 1973. You have often enough heard me say that when the body dies, the whole of the psychophysical organism disintegrates entirely. There is so much wishful thinking and proof producing by investigators whose minds are in a conditioned state of the survival of some immaterial entity which they would name the soul or something like that. And I have, you may recall, I have said again and again that this whole idea of immaterial entity is a self-contradictory idea. Because that which is immaterial, non-finite, shapeless, formless, has no dimensions whatsoever. It cannot. Otherwise it would have shape and form. It is no entity. When the psychophysical organism, which is a finite, living, mortal being, dies, as we say, all this which is manifest as the particular pattern named John Smith or Mary Brown is returned into infinity, non-finitude, the dimensionless, the immeasurable. And when that happens, there is no possibility of identification of that which is not particular and shaped and different from other such similar patterns. I know this is a very terrible thing to swallow, but don't swallow it. Digest it without swallowing it. One too often swallows thoughtlessly, and then it produces mental indigestion and lack of clarity of perception and understanding. Now, I've said all that before too, so you know it. And yet we all know that there is this curious longing for immortality in so many individuals, perhaps the majority of people in the world. They do not like to feel that themselves as particular persons, as egos, as personalities, use what word you like, are annihilated. They cannot let go of separate self-existence. The theistic religions of the world have invented perpetuity in heaven or hell for this separate ego, this immortal soul. If one lives rightly in this world, then there is a perpetuity of heaven, and heaven in every case is the pleasurable and the agreeable according to the inventive capacity, the mental inventive capacity of the propounder of that teaching. And hell, similarly, is a somewhat unpleasant place, again according to the intensity of the person's inventive capacity for horrible and cruel things. but perpetuity, the continuity of separate self, is something which in all the orthodox religions of the world exists. Even in Buddhism, which does away with so many aspects which we find in the other religions of the world, we do have the concepts of heaven and hell. And similarly, in Hinduism, we have the concepts of heaven and hell, and then a return to earth of this mysterious, immaterial entity, in order to go through a cycle of births and deaths, becoming better and finer and greater and more wonderful, till at last the inventive capacity, the imaginative capacity of the person who propounds it is completely exhausted, and then he tells you solemnly, don't ask any more questions. If you ask, what next? And under those circumstances, the mind is not clear enough and is incapable of investigating what might be something like the truth underlying a word like immortality. The founders of the religions, the holy ones themselves, all of them, have all talked of immortality. And scattered through the great scriptures of the world are very positive affirmations of a transcendent realization which they have named either immortality or, as in Buddhism particularly, the deathless state. What then is the truth about it? Let us see if we can investigate this a little bit this afternoon. Let us start with the Rig Veda. Pragata, one of the holy ones, a poet seer, says, comes in the 8th book of the Rig Veda, we have drunk soma and become immortal. We have seen the light, entered the light, the gods discovered. Recall those verses which I read some time back in that hymn to Soma, which comes in the 9th book of the Rig Veda, where the seer writes, place me in that deathless, immortal sphere where lucid worlds are full of light. You will find another of the great sages, Brihadeva by name, saying that he had thrown open all the doors of light and spoken to Indra in person. Indra, the great god, the personal lord of heaven. If you look at the Avasta of the Zarathustrians, you will find Zarathustra declaring, then did I behold thee, O Ahura Mazda, with my very eyes, when the good mind enveloped me. If you look at the Bible, you will find statements like this, starting with Genesis in the 5th chapter, And Enoch walked with God. And Enoch was not, for God took him. There is no statement to the effect that Enoch died. All his predecessors and his successors, up to and including Noah, they all lived so many years and died. But of Enoch it is not said that he died, but God took him. You find the story of Elijah and Elisha walking together and talking about things. And in the end, that chariot of fire appears. And Elijah is taken up in that chariot by a whirlwind. Most extraordinary symbolism is used there. The horsemen, the horses, the chariot of fire, the whirlwind, all these elements come into it. And he's taken up. There is no mention of Elijah's death as such. And of course, in the case of Jesus, we have, after the crucifixion, when he's supposed to be dead, the resurrection and ascension. If you look in the Upanishads, you will find statement after statement affirming this immortality. In the Kaushitaki Upanishad, when a man beholds that standing for the ultimate real Brahman, it is immortality that one finds. In the Kena Upanishad, when known by an awakening, it is conceived of. It is immortality that one realizes. In the greatest of all the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you find the statement by no less than Yajnavalkya, one of the greatest of all the teachers. Whilst we are here, we can know this. If one has not known it, then indeed one is in the state of sorrow. But he who knows it is liberated from death and finds immortality. And in the Mundaka Upanishad, there is that extraordinary statement that he who realizes Brahman crosses over sorrow, crosses over sin. He becomes very Brahman. He is indeed immortal. When you find statements like this, naturally, one says, of course, there is immortality. And then comes the mistake. Instead of saying there is immortality as a reality, I make the mistake of saying, yes, there is immortality for me. This is what the scriptures don't say. For me, the separate individual. Again, in the great mysticisms, particularly in Christian and Sufi, particularly Christian mysticism, there is the statement that the mystic's effort culminates in the unio mystica, the mystic union with God. Now, that's a tremendous statement to make. Now, what do all these statements mean? Let us consider this matter carefully, really carefully, with an open mind, with a sensitive mind. Try and put aside all preconceptions and beliefs and any authority to whom we give our allegiance. Every single thought, feeling, experience that we go through, every object, every event is categorized for us and by us in that system of symbolical sounds, words. Our awareness of our daily life, which is a succession of experiences due to the functioning of the senses and the brain, is in terms of words. There is, therefore, a constant stream of words characterizing our total awareness of our existence here whilst we are alive. A stream of words which are either spoken aloud and heard by others, or which constitute an endless stream of silent mental chatter. Now the word stands for objects, for actions, for relationships between objects and actions, and for the internal process of thought within ourselves, which we call imagination or abstract thought. And every single word represents something which is finite. Something which we are conscious of as a separate entity, a particular person, tree, animal, object, event, or whatever it may be. But do remember, it is finite. And that which is finite comes into being, and therefore being differentiated from other finite objects is recognizable as that object. It proceeds to exist in its own way, whether it be a live person or creature, or whether it be an inanimate object, and it finally comes to an end. In other words, it belongs to the realm of mortality. That which is born and that which dies. And our daily living experience is in terms of finitude and mortality. Our awareness is in terms of finitude and mortality. That is how we are conscious. We are conscious of a space-time universe, as we call it, in the mode of mortality. Everything comes, arises. We are conscious of its coming into being, its proceeding, its dying. Now this is the succession of births and deaths, which is a real meaning of the very misunderstood doctrine of rebirth. It takes place here in our own lifetime, whilst we are alive. This association of ourself in consciousness with the passing becoming stream. This is how we are aware. Note also that this awareness is also in terms of succession. One event takes place, occupying such and such a time, and in such and such a place, passes away, the next one comes up, and the next one comes up, passes away, and so on. So there's a constant succession of this process, which in our awareness, and due to the limitations of our consciousness, is experienced by us as a succession of births and deaths, of mortality. Is experienced by us as mortality, and in a succession. Now, is that quite clear? Our ordinary awareness of our everyday existence is in the mode of mortality. Now, throughout the ages, there have always been those, the few, who are in anguish because of this mortality. They were in real anguish about it. After all, consider, is not the most wonderful art, the finest system of philosophy, or whatever it is, something which is subject to this unidirectional time process, unidirectional birth, growth, death? Does it not all come to an end? And even if that philosophy or teaching darkly holds within itself the creative source which is declared to be immortal and eternal, still this philosophy, this belief, this idea, it comes to its ending. We may cling to it, but we always come up ultimately against the stark reality of death. And something in us knows that this too will die. So they were in profound anguish. They wanted to solve this problem of death. Because if they couldn't understand death, then no meaning invented for life would stand up against the reality itself, namely death. Now, they felt very, very passionately that if they could only break through the thorny bounds of ignorance, fling away the fetters of mortality, they would win the beatific experience of the immortal and the eternal here now, which meant real serenity, fulfillment, and freedom. Freedom in the truest and the profoundest sense. They saw that. Through constant communion with nature, and through close proximity at times with the creative source of things, these people experienced a changed mode of awareness. Instead of being aware in terms of the succession of births and deaths, of experience, of moods, of thought, of feeling, of actions, this changed mode of awareness supervened when they were in a quiet state within themselves. And in that quiet state, they noticed that the sense functions became calm. They were pacified. And when the sense functions were pacified, they noticed that this turbulent stream of discursive thought, this incessant mental chatter, stopped. the awareness of existence became free of bondage to the stream of words. That means to the stream of mortality, because words represent only that which is mortal, comes into being and dies, comes into being and dies, the finite, the limited, the particular. This is what they noticed. So, they investigated this throughout their lives and discovered that it was possible to come to that state of inner poise, an intensely awake, dynamic poise, in which the sense functions were utterly at peace, not suppressed, but utterly at peace. And the stream of words was no longer a turbulent stream, but became identical, if it existed at all, with the pellucid river of life itself. In other words, the dismembering, dissective, analytical aspect of the mind had ceased to interfere with the state of total, complete awareness of that which is here and now. And in that state of awakened awareness, there was no interference by a particular psychological condition of depression or elation or whatever, or anxiety or freedom or whatever it was. No interference by the particular state with that state of inward peace, that calm, that perfection, which maintained its calm and perfection right in the midst of the actual environment, which could be quite explosive. This is what happened. And they found that this way they were able to enter into profounder and profounder states of peace and of calm awakeness. Awakeness. So that they were not at all unaware of what was happening or going on. But they had ceased to interfere with what was happening. And they had ceased to react in all kinds of painful, miserable, troublesome ways to what was happening. They were masters of the situation. Not masters by domination, not in terms of imposing their will, but they were masters because they were unaffected by the storms. Now, as one enters into deeper states of consciousness, if one cannot successfully make a still deeper grade, one comes back to the old state of consciousness. If one is already in one of the really deep states and cannot make the next stage, one might fall asleep, like the disciples of Jesus did in the Garden of Gethsemane. They couldn't watch, and he bemoans the fact, "Could you not watch even 1 hour with me?" What were they watching? You see? It's a great mystery, isn't it? But this is what was happening, actually. This entry into the profound states of consciousness. They fell asleep. Sometimes, in those deep states, all sorts of things happen which are afterwards translated. When we come back to ordinary analytical intellectual processes, they are interpreted as visions, as auditions, and in all sorts of ways. they are given pictures, and these pictures and forms are the perfect expression of the actual conditioning we have gone through from our childhood and in our particular environment and culture. That is why the Lord God and the angels and the fairies and what not of any one culture will all be having the kind of dress and food and so forth which the people of that land have. English fairies will, if they were photographed, particularly if they were photographed in Victorian or Edwardian times, you see, will of course be like English gentlemen and ladies, you know, in their particular dresses. If anybody successfully photographs fairies in England, in this present age, they will, well, be very much like our lads and lassies whom we see in plenty around. So you see, the conditioning of the mind is betrayed there. But to look at it seriously, when one comes back, one says, oh, I had a message through the angel of the Lord, or the archangel Gabriel spoke to me. Islam, for instance, the Quran starts with the fact that the archangel Gabriel commanded Moses to write. Now this is the particular form which the mind gives to that which in itself is formless and which is transcendent. But in none of these states, howsoever wonderful they may seem, howsoever exalted and sublime, is there a true realization of immortality. Even in those moments when one is rapt beyond the senses in carefree rapture, creating wonderful art or whatever it may be, one is not free of the limited and the finite, the particular, and therefore of mortality. And it is as if in this communion with the ultimate, which is beyond all bounds, it is as if one realizes a proximity like two lovebirds in mid-air who suddenly fall apart. And that is all one can get to. Now let us look at what is taught in three of the great religious traditions of the world. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, we have the story of Adam who falls from grace. And Adam's fall is successively redeemed by Enoch, Elijah, and Jesus. Mind, this is what I say, this is not in the books. Enoch was not, for God took him. This is a redemption of the fall. From the fall. Because Adam was at home with God before the fall, wasn't he? Feel it out, see it. Elijah, similarly, and Jesus, with the resurrection and ascension, similarly. At least those three great redemptions take place as a result of the fall of Adam according to the Judeo-Christian tradition. In the Zarathustrian, Iranian tradition, we have a similar account of Yima, who becomes a great king. He is the beloved of the Lord. He is as if a representative of the Lord on the earth of Aurangzeb. And then Yima's fall takes place through pride. He thinks he's as good as the Lord and can do the things that the Lord does and so forth. Then it is said how the glory was seen to fly away from him. It's very interesting that they use that term glory, but I won't digress into that now, because it may be related to the to the original Kabbalistic idea of the Shekinah, the glory of God, you see. But in the Rig Vedic tradition, there is no fall. This is a very interesting little point. We have been dealing with the gods of the Rig Veda in recent months. We haven't dealt with Yama. Yama is the Rig Vedic counterpart of the Zarathustrian Yima. Now, Yima fell, but in the case of Yama, and there are only a very few hymns and a very few succinct statements only in the hymns of the 10th book particularly of the Rig Veda. Yama chooses death, abandons his body, and passes into the inner world, and is given lordship over the highest of the three heavens. Notice three heavens again, like St. Paul says, when he was caught up in the third heaven. Very interesting little point. Yama chooses death. Now remember, Yama is the heir to the Brahmanical tradition and the teaching, which had come down through centuries. What is the meaning of Yama choosing death? What does he die to? Obviously, he doesn't kill himself. He chooses death. That means he chooses to die to all worldliness. And if he chooses death that way, it means that he so completely understands the processes of the mind, the nature of his psyche, the nature of this greed which wants to grasp at everything, whether it be material objects or whether it be God and his heaven and angels and whatnot. He dies to all attachment to the desirable. He dies to all aversion from the painful. This is what he dies to. And when he dies to that, what happens? He is able to enter into that state of peace and quiet, where he is able completely to relinquish that which is limited, finite, particular. In consciousness. Relinquish in consciousness. Grasps at nothing. And this is the meaning of the word body in that context. Because body means that which is formed. That which is limited, particular. And therefore mortal. He abandons his body. And in this instance, the word body also means, because it represents the limited and the finite, it also means all his thoughts, his ideas, his beliefs, his convictions. The mind is utterly free, utterly purified, utterly empty. This is the meaning of Yama abandoning his body. And he passes into the other world. Now this other world is not the other world which saints and mystics have ordinarily talked of. The world of wonderful visions and auditions and all sorts of mystical experiences and so forth and so forth. Because in all of them there is this flow of discursive thought. The words are there. The complete cessation of this discursive thought takes place. Fully awakened awareness of that which is without the naming process. without the limiting, discriminating, separating process attached to that state of consciousness. You see? This is the important thing. And therefore, all uprising, proceeding, and dying, birth and death, have completely ceased in his awareness. Birth and death have ceased. Mortality has ceased to operate in that consciousness. And it is this state, when all discursive thought has stopped, when all birth and death has been overleaped, that one experiences in full the state which is called immortality, not mortality. And this is the meaning of immortality, which can be realized, be very careful, don't make the mistake of saying by you or by me, but through you. Because the experiencer is not a finite, limited being. The experiencer is the totality, is the eternal, is God, the absolute. The ultimate. That is the experiencer. The totality comes to realization of its own eternity through the phenomenon of immortality coming to life in you, the mortal being, in that state of utter unpossessiveness, of utter peace and quiet within yourself. And so you see, Yama is granted lordship over the highest of the three heavens. He becomes the master of death, the lord of death. And Yama must not be, in calling him the master of death, he must not be mistaken for Mrityu, or the Pali term Mara, who is the death dealer, the diabolus, who brings death, the wages of sin. And sin fundamentally means separativeness in your consciousness. So you see, Yama becomes the master of death, the lord of death. And in him, through him, is realized immortality. And this is the immortality which has real meaning in our individual lives. So you see how all the elements of religious discipline and religious living in the supreme sense play their part in bringing about this supreme fruition possible for man. The moralities, the indispensable basis, the discipline of the mind by which the mind relinquishes all forms, all objectives, all ambitions, all pursuits, and makes itself free for its true function, for perfect intelligence to function through one, which means the ability to see the truth of things with unerring insight as and when the things are there. That is intelligence, pure intelligence. See, all these elements play their part. And the crowning aspect of it, the state which is the state of perpetual communion. Meditation, contemplative prayer, use what terms you like. Now the Rig Veda itself gives, as I said, just a very few statements about it. I've tried to develop it so that we might perhaps get a glimpse of what is the real meaning of this word immortality. Its other real meaning is the fact that the totality is the everlasting totality. It is neither made more nor made less. The one total reality is everlastingly the one total reality. And in that sense, it is immortal, deathless as a totality. But it is composed of multitudinous particulars, each of which is an expression, a pressed out of its own being for the purpose of manifestation, in order that the face of this total reality, that the face of eternity may be made manifest untalkably, that's what I mean by the word inexpressibly here, beautiful ways. Because the entire universe is a universe of beauty. It is we who spoil it. It is man alone who is the blot upon the universe. Nothing else is a blot upon the universe as man is. And this is man's specific task in life, to cease to be a blot upon the universe. He has got that power of choice of opposing totality, of opposing God. Nothing else in the universe can oppose God. Now, this state of immortality, is the meaning of the word nirvana, of the kingdom of heaven. It is the meaning of the statement that Enoch was taken by God and Enoch was not. That Elijah went up in this chariot of fire to heaven. Symbolical terms to express that Elijah was in that state of awareness, that transcendent awareness. The same with the resurrection and the ascension. The old initiates of ancient Egypt knew all about this. 4,000 years practically before the birth of Christ and so forth. The holy ones of the Veda and the Upanishads, who span at least 20 centuries between the birth of Christ and the earliest records which we have, they all knew it. This was one of the supreme mysteries which was taught in the old mystery schools and so forth. This cessation of the flow of discursive thought. This is something which you'll find in Christian mysticism. Saint Teresa and the others have written quite openly of it. It is all there. Don't fall into the trap of thinking that any one particular religious tradition or group has the goods, so to say. Far from it. God has no favorites whatsoever. This is the meaning of the enlightenment of the Buddha. It lies right at the heart of the enlightenment. It is also the state of being in the kingdom of heaven. When you realize, or rather, see how easy it is to fall into the trap of putting it the wrong way. When this realization takes place through you, afterwards you remain permanently aware of the relationship between yourself and everyone and everything else. You know that you are in them and they are in you. Jesus said, "Believe me, I am in the Father, and the Father is in me." That's the meaning of it. In that state, is it possible to have enmity towards anything? Good, bad, indifferent, horrible, wonderful, whatever it is. There can be no enmity. There can only be complete relationship with any and everything that there is. And this is transcendent love. And in this state, one can transform. That is to say, the world gets transformed through you. Because you then are like the sun, which burns away, expends itself completely, giving out light and heat to everything around. Well, I think I better stop there today. One can talk quite a lot about it, but it becomes too much. Try and feel out the essence of it. Let the mind be open, so that the seed of truth, whatever truth, can drop into that open mind, may come to fruition. And it will spell also your well-being in the true sense of the term. And you will understand what is the meaning of that ineffable bliss which all the religions declare is the characteristic of the ultimate real.